This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFK. If you're not already a member, consider joining with us and keep free speech alive.
And you can go to the Deadline LA portion of the website to listen or download that November 7th show from the KPFK archive.
This week we're going to step back and look at the past, present, and future of the Getty, which has become one of the city's most important cultural institutions. And if you think that story is dry and uninteresting, you're about to be pleasantly surprised. With us again is Jason Felch. He's the co-author with Ralph Framolino of the book Chasing Aphrodite, The Hunt for Looted Antiquities at the World's Richest Museum. And it's a page-turner, I have to say. Jason, last week you walked us through the sordid narrative of how the Getty Museum spent millions on looted art and eventually had to return the art to its country of origin. But let's reach a little further back into the life story of this important Los Angeles institution. Who was J. Paul Getty, and how did he come to start a museum?
J. Paul Getty in the 1950s was the world's richest man. He was an oil baron. He had inherited an oil empire from his father and built it into an international conglomerate. And he had was quite a lousy character. He was a misanthrope. He treated women terribly. He didn't treat his family particularly well. He was a skinflint. He hated to spend money. He famously asked guests at his London home to use the payphone that he had installed if they needed to make a phone call. So he really had three passions in life. One was women, the other was money, and the third was art, and in particular, ancient art. So it was this that Getty dedicated himself to in his later life, and thanks to that, we have the J. Paul Getty Museum today.
But in the beginning, the museum itself, and I'm thinking of the Getty Villa along the coast, that wasn't really so much about art, was it?
Well, the museum has its origins in essentially a tax dodge. In the 1950s, while Getty was doing a lot of his art collecting, he was advised by his trusted tax advisor, Norris Bramlett, that if he, instead of just buying these objects and storing them at his house, if he actually created a museum in name only, he could get a tax write-off for all his acquisitions. So this is what J. Paul Getty did. He essentially dedicated a room in his Malibu ranch house and called it the J. Paul Getty Museum. And, you know, a few days a week, he would allow a few dozen guests in to see the collection. And in exchange for that, it was all tax exempt. That was the origin of the Getty Museum. Over the years, his collection grew enormously. And by the 1970s, he had to build a whole new edifice to house this collection. And this is what today we call the J. Paul Getty Villa in Malibu, or actually in Pacific Palisades. This was a Roman-style villa that Getty envisioned as the world's first museum dedicated to ancient art.
So he did kind of warm up to the idea of having an actual museum, as opposed to just an actual tax dodge.
He did. He had an interesting relationship with art. Like a lot of other areas in his life, he was looking for a bargain. So he oftentimes didn't buy the best art that was available for sale. He'd buy the best art that he could get at a cheap price. So when he dies in 1976, he leaves the Getty Museum with a pretty mediocre collection, focused in kind of several collecting areas, French furniture, some old master paintings, and predominantly ancient art. That was the best area of his collecting. It was this collection that then, after his death, went on to become the focus of his legacy.
I mean, part of what's extraordinary, really, about his decisions, about his will, is the people in his life got very little, and the museum unexpectedly got a windfall.
Very few people at the time thought that all of this enormous personal fortune, some $700 million, would go to the Getty Museum. He had spent a lot of his later life promising his various paramours that he would take care of them in his death. And so it was something of a surprise, especially to the museum staff. In the 1970s, when Getty died in 1976, the museum was run by a real kind of a bunch of characters, none of whom was very much of an authority in art, and none of whom was very well prepared to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to make the Getty into a collection worthy of this legacy. So they had to quickly get serious about what they were doing and bring in some serious people to manage this endeavor.
So one product of Getty's wealth, and besides his, as you talked about in the previous segment, besides his direct bequest, the subsequent sale of the Getty Oil Company just magnified that enormously, and all of a sudden you have the world's richest museum. And one product of Getty's wealth has been two spectacular museum sites. Tell us about those.
Well, the original site, which what was called the Getty Museum originally, is the one just up the Pacific Coast Highway. It's technically in Pacific Palisades, although everyone refers to it as the Getty Villa in Malibu. Today, that was the original museum. Today, it is one of the nation's only museums dedicated to ancient art and the study of ancient art. And so it now houses the Getty's still impressive collection of Greek, Roman, and Etruscan antiquities. The site that we know today as the Getty Center was opened in the mid-1990s at enormous expense. More than well over $1 billion was spent to create this hilltop Parthenon-like edifice.
Oh, hold on right there. You said well over $1 billion just to build the facility?
The Getty literally moved mountains to build this, the Getty Center. It was an incredible endeavor. It went over budget. Its initial budget was about $100 million. It came in well over that and came in several years behind schedule. It is an enormously expensive structure that is really quite remarkable. People flock to it as a tourist attraction and oftentimes ignore the art contained inside of it. It's just, in and of itself, it is really a modern acropolis. It is a tower on the hill, something to behold.
So, in some ways, the history of the Getty is very much in keeping with the legacy of its founder, who started the museum partly as a tax dodge, because as the museum was building its collection, you write that there was very soon after a scandal that involved a tax dodge with donors. Tell us about that.
That's right. Getty's hand-picked antiquities curator was a man named Jerzy Frel. Jerzy Frel was a Czech refugee, a very bright scholar of the ancient world, and he was brought to the Getty to help build its collection of ancient art. Well, Frel was quickly frustrated after Getty's death because the Getty's enormous wealth was being managed by this board of trustees that included a bunch of old oil men and a few of Getty's relatives and advisors. And Frel knew that in order for the Getty Museum to be taken seriously, it would need to have these incredible display-worthy objects, but would also need to have an important study collection. A study collection is the kind of bric-a-brac archaeological material that scholars love to ponder, but that the museum visitors never get to see. So the museum trustees would never approve the acquisition of these type of materials that Jerzy Frel thought was so important. So he decided to work around the trustees, and essentially what he did was create a tax fraud scheme. In essence, looted antiquities, recently excavated antiquities, were being brought into the United States and donated to the Getty Museum by wealthy Hollywood elite. You had all kinds of big-name people donating to the world's richest museum these archaeological objects, and their value was being inflated dramatically so that these donors could get tax write-offs from the IRS.
So, Jason, how would this work? How would a celebrity end up in the hands of a study collection-worthy piece of looted bric-a-brac?
Well, that's what's so clever about it, is the celebrities never saw the objects they were donating. In essence, this was a scheme to help move this kind of second-tier material that was being churned up by looters throughout the Mediterranean and bring it into the museum without the Board of Trustees' approval. So the celebrities involved never actually saw the material that they were claiming as donations. They were simply getting a tax form saying that they had donated $300,000 worth of archaeological material to the Getty. They were recruited by a man named Bruce McNall, who will be familiar to many of your listeners. He went on to run the Kings and the LA Kings and to do some time on a bank fraud case. In earlier incarnation, Bruce McNall was an expert in ancient Roman coins and contrived with Jerzy Frel and a very prominent middleman in the antiquities trade to create this tax fraud scheme that would fill the Getty with recently looted ancient art and give these Hollywood donors their tax write-offs.
But who was paying for the looted art in the end?
Well, the looted art was being paid for unknowingly by the Board of Trustees.
So it was being paid for by the Getty at something
by the
close.
Getty.
Okay. At something close to its true value, which was not necessarily enormous, but meanwhile these donors were claiming that these art pieces were of enormous value and they were getting huge tax write-offs.
Exactly. Exactly right, yeah.
So
Jerzy Frel would oftentimes make a deal with someone in the antiquities world, and the person would say, I have this Roman bust, it's worth $200,000. And Frel would say, well, that's not good enough, how about I pay you $400,000, and you bank the extra $200,000, and you use that to bring in this other material. He was, it was hook, crook, or steal, however he could get these objects into the museum.
And the trustees never said, hey, Jerzy, where's this stuff coming from?
keep in mind at the time that the chairman of the board of the Getty Museum was a man named Howard Berg, who had been a wildcatter, an oil man just like Getty and a close friend of J. Paul Getty. Howard Berg and his ilk on the board were not exactly experts in ancient art. They weren't asking too many questions. And so it didn't appear to catch anybody's attention that the world's richest museum was receiving more charitable donations than any other museum in the country, until years later when the former director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Thomas Hoving, caught wind of this and started to raise red flags.
So eventually it all comes crashing down, and Frell leaves the country, and there's sort of a reform movement at the Getty. I mean, it's a huge scandal, partly substantially uncovered by LA Times reporting, as I recall. And so, you know, the Getty is on notice that it needs to clean up its act, but they make a critical error, it seems, that they interpret what went wrong as a tax fraud problem, not a looted antiquities problem.
That's right. The IRS was investigating a lot of the donors who had donated to the Getty, and the Getty knew that it had exposure to a conspiracy to commit tax fraud charge. And so they ushered Yerzy Frell out of the country and quickly kind of covered up his excesses and brought in a young curator named Marion True to help steer the department clear. What they didn't quite gather at the time, and this was really a reflection of the era, was that the acquisition of these looted antiquities would be just as big a problem as tax fraud would eventually. Marion True came in and continued to build the Getty's collection. She didn't use tax fraud to do it, but she was buying objects that we now know were recently excavated in violation of both foreign laws and international treaties, and some would argue American laws.
And Jason, I assume that it was at about this time where the tax fraud scandal became public that Getty also developed what was a pretty sophisticated or very careful public relations effort. And I wondered, were you covering the story at that point? And what do you know about sort of the arc of the Getty's PR efforts to control this story over a period of 20 years?
It's an important part of the story. I didn't cover this in the 1980s, obviously, but in the course of reporting on the book, we had access to internal Getty documents going back all the way to the 70s. And when you read those documents and you read about the internal meetings, senior Getty officials, really at the highest levels, what you see is a consistent theme. The Getty is not worried about doing what is right. It is oftentimes concerned with doing what looks to be right. And so a curator in the antiquities department in the 1980s described their policy towards acquiring objects as optical due diligence. Well, optical due diligence is make sure it looks like we're doing the right thing, but let's keep doing whatever we want. And that was really what guided the Getty, was a desire to be seen doing the right thing, but to continue doing what it wanted. And what it wanted to do was buy ancient art. And so over the years, this comes back again and again. And in essence, I mean, this is something we see in other scandals where people focus on the optics as opposed to doing the right thing. And at the Getty, it meant that the underlying problem at the institution was never really addressed. They kept focusing on how it could be spun or made to look better. But the essence of their problem was that they were buying stuff that was illegally excavated. And they didn't really wrestle that to the ground until quite recently.
Well, that was actually my next question. Is the fact that you had access to those documents indication that the Getty is now concerned about doing the right thing as opposed to making it look like it's doing the right thing?
Well, no. I mean, we had access to those documents because, as is true at a lot of institutions that are on the wrong track, there are people inside the institution who try to speak up and make warnings about where it's headed and aren't listened to. Those people often become sources for investigative reporters. And so that was the case at the Getty. I mean, we have more than a dozen people who came to us and offered us remarkable access to the Getty's internal deliberations over several years because they were unhappy with the direction the institution was going. The Getty's reckoning really came not because of some, I would argue, some internal conclusion that it was the right thing to do, but really in the face of kind of public humiliation and an international scandal that kind of forced them to repair their image. And, you know, to their credit, I think it's quite remarkable that the changes the Getty went through, has gone through in the last 5 years or so since the scandal first broke. They have become, they've gone from kind of being pariahs of the museum world to really becoming ethical leaders and kind of forging a way forward out of this problem.
We're talking with Jason Felch. You're listening to Deadline LA on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and a growing list of affiliates. You can also listen online live. You can download podcasts. You can go to the archive page. You can do things I don't even know how to do on the Internet. And Jason Felch is the author of, the co-author with Ralph Framolino, of Chasing Aphrodite, The Hunt for Looted Antiquities at the World's Richest Museum. It is a page-turner. You have to take my word for that. And the book is available. And we've been talking about the scandals at the Getty Museum, mostly related to the looting of antiquities. Now, you talked about your sources were people, many of your sources were from the Getty, people trying to actually do the right thing and being on the losing end of decisions. And it might help people to understand in terms of that element that the Getty is not just a museum that collects antiquities. It's a museum with many arms, or an institution with many arms. Could you break that down a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. When the Getty came into its enormous wealth in the early 1980s, the CEO at the time, Harold Williams, realized that if they spent all of that money just buying art, that they would essentially destroy the art market. And so he came up with a plan to develop several different arms of the Getty Trust, the umbrella foundation over the Getty. One of those was the museum that we all know. There were several other programs, though, that the Getty spends its money on. Today, the primary programs that exist are a conservation institute, which has really some of the best science going on about how to preserve artwork, and in particular their strength is ancient art, so how to protect and preserve ancient art. You have a research institute, which is really has an incredible library, an art history library, and does a lot of cutting-edge work to promote research into the arts. And you have a foundation, which is essentially a grant-making program that provides funds to institutions around the world to protect and preserve and display their own art. So it's this umbrella of organizations that is really the Getty Trust, and they do remarkable stuff in lots of different areas in lots of different parts of the world. Because the museum is the most prominent of these and also the most controversial, there's oftentimes been a lot of conflict within the Getty family between what the museum was doing, which was essentially promoting the destruction of the ancient world by fostering looting and by creating a real demand for ancient art, and its partner, the Conservation Institute, which travels the globe and talks with leading archaeologists and governments about how to protect the ancient world. So there's a conflict built within the Getty's own DNA that has long been a source of controversy within the institution.
Well, I sort of think of the two figures, you know, one on your shoulder telling you to do bad things and the other saying the angel sitting on the other shoulder. And those two forces were actually embodied within the Getty, although the angel was sort of silenced for many years. And you know, actually, I want to make it clear. So for listeners who don't necessarily get this, some people might look at looting, you know, sort of finding something in the ground or at the bottom of the ocean, a piece of art, and if a fisherman or a farmer finds this art and sells it through a chain, isn't that a victimless crime? I mean, the original owners are long gone. It's just something found in the ground or at the bottom of the ocean. Why is it bad to take that out of its context and have it displayed at a museum where millions of people can see it, where it'll be taken care of and lovingly restored?
It's a good question and one that's important to address. The museum has always justified what it's been doing by saying, we're rescuing these objects. When you look at how the international antiquities trade works, it is a black market that really promotes the destruction of the ancient world. When these ancient objects are found in their situation, where they were buried long ago, when they're found in that situation and carefully excavated, we have incredible knowledge about the ancient world. We can draw all types of conclusions about what this object means and meant to the people who made it, what significance it might have played for them in their lives at the time. When these objects are looted, all of that potential knowledge is really destroyed, and what you have left is this mute object of beauty. You have a pretty piece of stone, and so if you look at this as a piece of art, it has value. It's a beautiful thing, but if you look at it as an artifact, it has almost no value because it's been stripped of its meaning. What the Getty and other American museums have done, these are educational institutions whose mission, whose tax-exempt mission, is to promote knowledge, to educate us. What they've done by buying these looted antiquities is to create a market for the destruction of the knowledge of the ancient world. They've kind of encouraged that destruction by paying tens of millions of dollars for these things, and spurring the looting of untold more archaeological sites in the hopes of finding this type of material.
Well, and so, as you make clear in the book, there's a constant fight going on inside the Getty between the art people and the archaeology people.
Absolutely. I mean, Luis Monreal was the head of the Conservation Institute at the Getty at the time that the Getty bought the Statue of Aphrodite. And he was livid that the Getty would buy this beautiful ancient statue, because it was very clear to him that this had been recently looted. There's no other object like this in the world. And he knew that its illegal removal from wherever it had been found meant that we would never really know what this thing meant. Well, flash forward 40 years, and Luis Monreal proved to be right. The statue of Aphrodite, we call her Aphrodite because she's a voluptuous goddess in a windblown drapery. She's since been returned to Sicily, and scientists today believe that she's actually not Aphrodite, that she's probably Persephone, the goddess of fertility and the harvest. It's an example of the lost information that when this object was smuggled through the antiquities market, we lost her identity. We lost her real meaning. And only now that she's been returned to Sicily are we beginning to recreate what she might have meant to the people who made her. That's the cost of looting, and that's the cost of buying objects on this black market.
So in the end, when this latest scandal unfolded, the Getty returned to the country of origin, countries of origin, more than 40 pieces of looted art that it had paid millions for. Museums around the country and around the world really had to follow suit. But for the Getty, first of all, what was left? How diminished is the Getty's collection as a result of these returns?
It's hard to quantify exactly the blow, but no one would argue that this was an incredibly devastating blow to the collection. I mean, perhaps the museum's most iconic object, the statue of Aphrodite, is no longer there. There are dozens more iconic pieces, pieces that the Getty itself described as masterpieces of the ancient world. Their value, their economic value is well north of $100 million, but really their art historical value and their importance in the collection is hard to underestimate. The collection is really devastated by these returns. That would be a bad news story if they hadn't been replaced by these incredible loans that we're now seeing from Italy that came as a byproduct of this agreement.
Well, let's talk about that. So there have been some positive developments that have come from the Getty scandal. One is the removal of this impetus to loot from the major art museums that was fueling the trade, and then this loan program. So talk about that.
So when the Getty decided to return these objects, it also essentially disavowed buying in the future objects of this nature, things that had been illicitly excavated. And that policy was adopted by and large by museums all across the country as a result of this controversy. So as you said, the demand for these type of objects has largely, at least coming from American museums, has largely been curtailed. In exchange, the Italian authorities agreed to loan museums that had returned these objects, objects of comparable beauty. And so what we've seen flow from these agreements is a stream of remarkable ancient objects from Italy. The first to arrive at the Getty was what's an object called the Chimera of Arezzo. It's this ancient Etruscan bronze sculpture of a chimera. And it's really quite a remarkable piece of art. It had never left Italy before, and it came to the Getty and spent several months there on display as it was conserved and protected. This is really the model for the future. This is the way that museums can stop relying on the black market for their ancient objects, and the Italians are aware of this and are trying to suggest this as a kind of a path forward. If museums stop their reliance on the black market, they can obtain from Italy some of these gorgeous pieces of ancient art. And you're not just getting this beautiful, mute object of beauty. What comes with an object like the Chimera of Arezzo is this incredibly detailed story about how it was excavated, when it was excavated, and thanks to that information, what it meant to the Etruscans who made it, and what role it might have played in their mythology, and its whole collecting history down through the ages, how it had passed from this ancient civilization through collectors until it got to the Getty. So these objects are far more rich when they come officially excavated, and we're seeing the byproduct of that today. If you go to the Getty Villa, you'll see any number of objects on loan from Italy, thanks to this agreement.
And Jason, so how significantly have these new practices of more exchanges and a more respecting of the sort of provenance of objects that were once looted, what impact has that had on the looted art market?
If you ask Italian authorities, they'll say that since these investigations began in the mid-1990s, they've seen a marked decline in the scope of looting, in the scale of looting in Italy. But looting has not gone away, neither in Italy nor anywhere else. Really, what this moment marks is a path forward that we can choose to adopt. So it's an answer that is out there for us, but it is by no means solved the crisis. Looting continues across the world and is still driven by demand. American museums in the area of Greek and Roman art have largely cleaned up their acts. But go to your local museum and look at their ancient pre-Columbian art. Look at their Southeast Asian art. A lot of these objects came through very similar smuggling networks and through very similar circumstances. And those activities still continue across the globe. So it is not, I hope not to send the message that really problem solved and everything's hunky-dory. Looting is still very much of a problem in the world, and we see signs, even today, that museums are still on the receiving end of some of these objects in other areas of collecting.
Well, in the Getty itself, aren't they in a conflict right now over pages torn from an ancient Bible?
That's correct. There's an ongoing court case right now involving the Getty over 8 illuminated pages, beautifully decorated pages of an Armenian Bible that was broken up sometime after the Armenian genocide, and these pages made their way to the United States. The Getty acquired these 8 pages in 1994 for about $1 million. The rest of the Bible is in a museum and now Armenian authorities are asking for the return of these 8 pages to make the Bible complete. Somewhat interestingly, the Getty, which has really made a name for itself since this controversy as kind of a leading ethical mover in this area, the Getty is arguing that these pages should not be reunited with the rest of the Bible, that they bought them and should be able to retain them. It's an interesting sign of that these questions are still very much alive and that these issues of ownership aren't going away anytime soon.
Our guest today has been Jason Felch. He's the co-author with Ralph Framolino of Chasing Aphrodite. It's a new book. It's the full title is Chasing Aphrodite, The Hunt for Looted Antiquities at the World's Richest Museum. Jason, thanks so much for being our guest. If you want to listen to the entire interview, go online to kpfk.org, and you can catch our interview with him last week as well.
I'm Barbara Osborne for Deadline LA. Thanks to the engineering crew for getting us on the air, and thanks to you for listening.
KPFK would like to thank Cooperatunity, Santa Monica's Natural Foods Cooperative Store, along with the following food donors from the Santa Monica Farmers Market for generously helping to feed our volunteers during our fall fund drive. Shaner Farms, Bernard Ranches, thanks Gabriel, Polito Family Farms, Tutti Frutti Farms, Finley's Organic Farms, Bezian's Bakery, Haas Apple Farm, Fair Hill Farms, Fairview Gardens, Florabella Farms, Summer Harvest Farm, shout out to Susie, Batista Organic Date Ranch, Gloria's Fruits and Vegetables, Munac Ranch, thanks Hugo, Organic Pastures, thanks Miel, Weiser Family Farms, and special thanks to Israel Foyer. When you frequent these fine establishments, please thank them for donating to your favorite radio station, KPFK.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.